From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with British actress Joan Plowright. She's now starring in the movie Widow's Peak. She'll talk about acting and about working with her late husband, Sir Laurence Olivier. Also, It's My Party and Judy's Turn to Cry aren't exactly songs of sisterhood, but you could consider You Don't Own Me a proto-feminist anthem. We feature an interview with singer Leslie Gore about those early hits from the 60s and her cabaret act. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews I Love Trouble, starring Julia Roberts and Nick Nolte. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Crowds of Palestinians are welcoming Yasser Arafat back to Gaza. The PLO chairman was mobbed today as thousands of Palestinians gathered to greet his return. He spoke to thousands more gathered in Gaza City. It's the first time Arafat has been in Gaza since 1967, when the Israelis captured the land during the Six-Day War. Many Israeli Jews are not happy with Arafat's trip. Several are holding demonstrations in Jerusalem. There have been threats made against him as well. The Department of Education announced today that college students will now be able to repay the federal loans they take out over a 30-year period. The administration hopes this new plan will lower the default rate. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Students taking out federal loans can choose between a traditional 10-year repayment plan or stretch out payments over 30 years. The idea is to make it easier for graduates who don't earn large salaries to repay the government. In addition, students who now hold the traditional 10-year loans will be able to switch over to the new 30-year payback plan if they choose. Under the new law, the government will finance student loans directly rather than channel the program through banks. Education Secretary Richard Riley said the direct loan program will save the government $4.3 billion over 5 years. A note of caution to students, interest accrued over 30 years could wind up doubling or tripling the amount of money owed. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Senate has adopted a measure that urges President Clinton to work for peace in the former Yugoslavia. The body narrowly rejected another bill that would have forced the president to break the weapons embargo on the former Yugoslav Republic. The vote was 50-50, and Vice President Al Gore cast the tie-breaking vote to reject it. Former television evangelist Jim Baker has been freed, from a federal prison today and will spend the next several months in a halfway house in North Carolina. Kevin Marks of member station WFAE reports from Charlotte.
Baker spent 4.5 years behind bars, most recently in Jessup, Georgia. Now he'll finish out his sentence at a halfway house in Asheville, North Carolina. He'll work at an area business by day and stay at the Salvation Army halfway house at night. Baker could be freed December 1st. The former evangelist was convicted in 1989 of defrauding his PTL followers of more than $150 million and was sentenced to 8 years in prison. In a statement released this morning, Baker says it is with great joy and thanksgiving to God that he walks free today. He says he looks forward to spending time with his family, and Baker again is asking forgiveness of those who were offended or hurt by his, quote, sin and arrogant lifestyle. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Marks in Charlotte, North Carolina.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 16 points at 3,641. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq has fallen more than a point to 704. This is NPR. Officials say today that a test flight of an Airbus A330, in which 7 crew members were killed, was carried out in extreme conditions in France. Yesterday's accident was the first time an Airbus has crashed during a test flight in more than 20 years. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The head of Europe's four-nation Airbus consortium said the A330 crashed while the crew was testing an automatic pilot. The official said the test consisted of putting the plane into a steep climb at a low speed after takeoff, simulating an engine failure and cutting a hydraulic circuit. He said the plane was flying at a very low altitude, 1,300 feet, and that while the pilot regained control of the plane, he was not able to avoid hitting the ground. The official said Airbus will decide in the next few weeks whether to repeat the test in less difficult conditions. There are 5 Airbus A330s on the market, and the company has orders for 118 more. The A330 that was tested was a new version of the plane. for National Public Radio. This is Lynn Terry in Paris.
New York's trains and buses are still running, even though workers don't have a contract. Negotiations go on as both sides hope to reach agreement on a new contract covering 32,000 drivers, mechanics, signal maintainers, and cleaners who work for the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. The old contract expired at midnight. 3.5 million people use the MTA every day. An MTA spokesman says his agency has no contingency plans for a strike. Meanwhile, workers for San Francisco's rapid transit system, the BART, have agreed to a new contract with the company. The Bay Area rapid transit workers have clinched a new 3-year agreement, and the deal averts a threatened strike. The two unions that represent 1,900 train workers and clerical employees say they'll present their offer to their membership for a vote. Workers lifted a strike deadline to keep the talks going. BART says a strike would have been disastrous. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Joan Plowright is one of England's leading actresses, and she was married to one of England's finest actors, Sir Laurence Olivier, from 1961 until his death. Plowright is best known as a stage actress, but over the past few years she's been making more movies. She's now starring in Widow's Peak. Her other films include The Dressmaker, Avalon, Drowning by Numbers, and The Summer House. When I spoke with Plowright in 1991, she told me about her training at the Old Vic Theatre School.
It was a wonderful training, but it was very specifically for, I would say, classical theatre. It was to do with voice, speech, movement, dance, fencing. Even the girls learnt fencing. It was a very serious training and very tough. I mean, the end of each term at the Old Vic Theatre School where I trained, there were people who were told they should not continue. So it was very hard. It was very nerve-wracking. But it was a very sound and wonderful basic training.
Are you glad you learned how to fence? Has that come in useful for anything?
Well, I am glad, actually, because I played Viola in a television film of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, and I did have to fence, because Viola dresses up as a boy, with Sir Ralph Richardson, who was playing Sir Toby. And we had quite a long sword fight, which was highly dangerous because he was no better at it than I was. But at least I'd had some training. I could look fairly good at it.
In Laurence Olivier's memoirs, he writes about the first time that you met. And he describes going backstage to congratulate all the actors at a performance of The Country Wife. And he is trying to imagine what your reaction was to him, and he says, "I divined that I stood for everything that the young generation at the royal court would find most objectionable, and everything that was most odious to a girl of this generation of actors who had come from North Lines. I was titled, necessarily self-satisfied, pompous, patronizing, having obviously come to visit in a spirit of condescension. I could see it all." What did you think about the older generation of actors and Laurence Olivier at the time? Was he accurate in those perceptions?
Half, yes. I mean, after all, we were very young. We had set up an outpost in Sloane Square at the Royal Court Theatre. We were doing the work of new contemporary writers of our own age, of John Osborne, Harold Pinter,
who is the
Tom
we that
Stoppel.
You're referring to?
The company, the We, was the English stage company. It was actors like Albert Finney, Alan Bates, Peter O'Toole, girls, me, and Billy Whitelaw. We were most of us from the provinces, not born in London, not with Kensington, London accents. We were from all over. And we, because of the success of John Osborne's play Look Back in Anger, we were all known as angry young men and angry young women. I mean, we weren't all that angry, but we did get lumped together, and that's why I say we at the time. That was a title that was used about me in interviews, even when I first came over to New York with A Taste of Honey. You know, he represented a theatre that we were fighting to abolish.
What did you want to abolish?
Drawing room comedies, and where people came on in white flannels with a tennis racket and said, anyone for tennis. It was that sort of theatre that we were trying to get rid of. We were political. We were very left-wing. And Larry, to us, I suppose, looked very right-wing. Now, that is not to say that one was not aware of a great talent. And I think what he saw when he came and said that about me was a thing that I was, along with my friends, determined not to be impressed just because he was coming to see us. We thought, quite right, he should come and see us. We've got something very good going here. At the same time, you don't have to make a decision to not to be impressed unless somewhere inside you, you are deeply impressed, if you see what I mean.
Right, exactly.
So that's your answer, really.
When did you change your mind about Laurence Olivier and decide that he wasn't just... You had pointed out you were already very impressed with him, but still he did represent the other generation and a more conservative spirit in the theatre.
Well, obviously it was when I started rehearsing the Osborne play The Entertainer with him, and here was a man who was nothing to do with the reputation, but... an actor, an entertainer, a huge talent on that stage, came on and took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves and acted everybody off the stage with a force and a power and an energy that was very startling. Also a man who would, you know, just go next door into the pub with all the actors and talk as a human being. Getting to know him properly was a revelation as against the image, which I think was a wrong image anyway, but which he couldn't help having achieved.
Laurence Olivier, in his book on acting, reprints some of the letters that that he wrote to you with some advice to it. Advice on acting to you about some performances. And he said to you in one of the letters, you don't know how lucky you are to be able to cry at will on stage. I've never been able to do it in my life.
Yes.
Was that a problem for him? And was it something that you were especially proud of being able to do?
No, because honestly, a lot of people can, you know. It isn't a gift in any way. It's a weakness, perhaps. But as far as he was concerned, I mean, he could make people believe that he was crying, perhaps more powerfully than actors who were actually crying. I mean, to be on stage, you know, it is an art form. It is a craft. I mean, you can play Juliet yourself in the bathroom, lying in the bath, and move yourself quite intensely and cry real tears. If you are actually on a stage and you do it in the same way, you are nobody beyond the first row in the theatre is going to know at all what you're doing. They are not going to see the tears. Your voice is going to be clogged with emotion anyway, so they're not going to hear. What Larry could do was project an image of somebody in great grief and crying without actually doing it. Now, that is great acting, and it is often more powerful than the real thing. That is in theatre we're talking about. On film, it would be totally different.
One other thing that Laurence Olivier wrote you in a letter that I wanted to mention, he wrote, a humble approach to our work is essential, but how do we equate the essential humility towards the work with the full possession of confidence required to carry it off? And that just struck me as a really interesting dilemma, and I wonder if that's something you feel you've had to contend with during your career, the humility that you need to really approach a role and the confidence to pull it off, especially, you know, in the light of the fear of rejection that so many actors have. I think actors are very vulnerable about that.
Yes, you're right. It is, I mean, it is a constant problem. And it varies through stages in your life. Very early on, you probably have a great deal of confidence, but you, because you are still promising and you haven't yet had the knocks. I remember being interviewed by a journalist who said to me, "Why are you being so evasive with me?" He said, "You are a journalist's daughter. Surely you know the golden rule. We never knock you when you're on the way up. It's only when you get there that we'll shoot you down." Now, if that is a golden rule, it's not a very pleasant one, but it does seem to apply a great deal. And therefore, once you have achieved some kind of name or reputation, the nerves get worse. Therefore, the confidence gets more shaky because you have more to lose.
Was there a period in your life where you felt that that was really at its strongest, that sense of that you had the most to lose and your nerves were shaky?
Yes, quite possibly. At the opening of the National Theatre, where my first role was St. Joan, and that was really all right because I'd done that before. We repeated two plays from a previous season when we opened the National Theatre. But the next leading role I did, I think, I was more worried and shaky in confidence in that I was playing Masha in Chekhov's Three Sisters, and Larry was directing it, and I had the sort of double responsibility of him as director and being my husband and me as leading lady, and the worry that, it was the burden might be too much. So it was a shaky start to that.
What kind of reviews did you get for that?
They were actually marvellous, as it turned out. But, the rehearsal, the preparation was the fearful time.
It must be hard when you're getting directed by your husband in something, because, there's times, I think, when you really want to resist the director. And, I don't know, when you're that close, it must be hard to take direction in a way.
Yes, it does have its problems, but then, you have to be able to argue and not feel that, you know, for the sake of his reputation in front of the rest of the company, you can't say a word. You have to be very open about that and be able to argue as any actress would who was not married to him.
We're featuring a 1991 interview with Joan Plowright. She's now starring in the film Widow's Peak. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Joan Plowright. When we left off, we were talking about working with her late husband, Sir Laurence Olivier. When you both fell in love and decided to marry, you were both married to other people.
Yes.
And Olivier was married to Vivian Leigh, and this was a very well-known relationship. And she had sent out a public statement saying that Olivier was asking for a divorce in order to marry you. And this was at a time when you were both performing in a play together.
Yes.
And it was decided that you should leave the production. I think Olivier suggested this. You should leave the production. After her statement became public, what was the reasoning behind asking you to leave?
Oh, because he knew the amount of press attention that would be there, and he didn't think I was aware of the of how much there would be, which, of course, I wasn't.
Looking back, do you think that was the right way to handle it?
Yes, I believe it was. It would have been ridiculous for us both to have had to leave the theatre every night to crowds of photographers and people, wouldn't it?
What are some of the problems involved with having a relationship that's a very public relationship, whether you want it to be public or not, public in the sense that, you're two public people who audiences want to know about?
That is a decision to take very early on. It was one of the reasons why we chose to live in Brighton, away from London, by the sea, that we could bring up our children in comparative privacy. And you can avoid it, you know, if you want to, if you wish to lead a rather secluded private life with only chosen friends, you can do so. The fact that we had to catch a train every night to Brighton from London, it was an hour's journey, put out of the way a lot of sort of social events that we might have been involved in otherwise, and which we didn't really want to be involved in. I mean, we were very, very determined to spend as much time as possible together. We had the house in Brighton by the sea, a flat in London, and a house in the country. And it was Brighton and the country where we spent a lot of time. We had a growing family. And really, you know, people who are very much in love and bringing up a family are not news value anymore as when they're having adulterous right. affairs and getting divorced. You know, they're not of that much interest. Their work is, but their private life, once it's settled, is not.
I think that's a very interesting point that you've just made. If you're just joining us, my guest is actress Joan Plowright. You took time off from theater to raise your children. You have three children?
Yes.
How much time did you end up taking away from acting? It was really only
18 months each time. I mean, once it was 2 years, I think, when I had each of the children. I wanted, obviously, that bond between mother and child to be there for the first 2 years if I could, without the kind of interruption of work. It was essential to me at that stage. For that time I did it, I didn't miss the excitement, the nerves, the nerve-wracking days of dress rehearsals and previews and openings. I felt a great relief at being away from it, but then suddenly the urge came back.
Do you ever get out of practice when you haven't acted for a couple of years?
Yes, you do get out of practice. There's just that thing of, in theatre, for instance, of stepping onto a stage for the first time. If you haven't done it for 2 years... I remember going back into a play at the Old Vic. I took over from Maggie Smith in Much Ado About Nothing at the National Theatre. We often took over from each other in parts. And I hadn't been on the stage for 2 years. And I hadn't realised that this production started with the curtain up. And at a preview, I went into the wings just 5 minutes before the curtain was due to go up, as I thought, and walked on stage to practice my first line and saw an entire house full of people who all stopped talking to each other and looked expectantly at me. And I realised that the house was in, the curtain was up, and I was not starting the play, I was merely practising, ran off into the wings in great confusion. When the play did start and I came on again, my throat closed on my first line, and I could not speak. And it stayed like that for, I suppose, 30 seconds of an epiglottal stop every time I tried to say the first word.
This is sounding very much like the classic actor's nightmare, but it actually happened to
you. Yes, it is. It did actually happen. It never happened again, because I was more careful, but that is a... that kind of shock to your system, a nervous system, coming back and being out of practice can do quite alarming things.
You've made some movies in America as well as in England.
Yes.
Do you think that there's a different approach to acting and directing in America?
Well, I mean, the film industry is America. I mean, it is America's tradition, it is America's medium, and it is therefore much more relaxed over here making movies. I don't think there's fundamentally a different approach. I mean, after all, convincing, truthful acting is the same in any country, whether English-speaking or not. An audience recognises the truthful performance. Directors and actors in America simply have far more scope and much more opportunity to practice their craft than in England, where the industry is very much beleaguered at the moment.
Joan Plowright, recorded in 1991. She's now starring in the film Widow's Peak. I want to close this half hour with a recent recording by Laverne Baker, who we'll hear from on the next edition of Fresh Air. Baker had R&B hits in the late 50s like Bumblebee, Tweedledee Dee, and Jim Dandy. She lived in the Philippines during the 70s and 80s. A couple of years ago, she released an album called Woke Up This Morning, featuring this version of Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Once I lived the life of a millionaire, spending my money, I didn't care. I cared my friends out for a mighty good time, buying bootleg liquor, champagne and wine. But just as soon as my money got low, I didn't have a friend and no place to go. So if I ever get my hands on a dollar again, I'm gonna squeeze it, I mean squeeze it till the eagle grins. Because nobody knows you when you're down and out. Now in your pocket, one penny, all those good time friends, you haven't any, no. Just as soon as you get up on your feet again, soon you will meet all your long lost friends. Oh, it's mighty strange, oh, oh, without a doubt, nobody knows you, oh, no, no, when you're down and out.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1963, she was 16, her hair was in a flip, and her first record rose to number one on the charts. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Leslie Gore about her hits from the 60s, like It's My Party, Judy's Turn to Cry, and You Don't Own Me. And we find out what she's been up to since then. Also, I Love Trouble. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of the new comedy, starring Julia Roberts and Nick Nolte as newspaper reporters on the trail of the big story. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The State Department says more than 5,000 Haitian boat people have been picked up over the last 2 weeks. At least 33 Haitian refugees drowned today when Haitian police fired on a sailboat filled with refugees who were trying to flee the troubled country. NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports from Port-au-Prince.
Eyewitnesses told reporters that at least 30 people and maybe as many as 40 were drowned off the remote southern village of Nonletat on Wednesday. They were among about 200 Haitians who'd set off to seek political asylum in the United States, crowded aboard a 60-foot sailboat. The witnesses said the refugees were intercepted by a Haitian military patrol boat, which fired rifle shots into the air, causing panic aboard the overcrowded vessel. Dozens of people fell into the sea. Most of them could not swim. The tragedy is the worst incident during the current surge of boat people fleeing Haiti. Haiti's military regime warned in May that people trying to leave the country illegally would be arrested. The army fears that a mass exodus of refugees could provoke U.S. military intervention here. In Haiti, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
The Red Cross is trying to reunite families separated by the Bosnian conflict. Starting this weekend, the International Committee of the Red Cross will begin airing a radio program that seeks to bring family members together. The program is a joint venture between the relief group and the BBC. It will air on Sundays across Europe on shortwave and medium-wave frequencies. Each week, the program will broadcast 80 messages that were not able to be delivered through the Red Cross message system. The Red Cross says its messages have helped millions of people in the former Yugoslav Republic get back in touch with their families. President Clinton has met with several congressional Democrats today. They're mapping out ways to get health care legislation on the floors of both the House and the Senate later this month. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Key Democrats emerged from their meeting with the president to say despite the odds, they remain confident health care, welfare reform, and sweeping anti-crime legislation will make it through Congress this year. House Majority Leader Richard Gebhardt says he's heard the threat of filibuster before.
We face filibuster threats on campaign reform and on crime and on health care. But I believe at the end of the day, the Senate is going to understand that the American people want a majority of their representatives to be able to vote on issues that are important in their lives as these issues are.
Calling himself an optimist, Gebhardt says he still believes Congress will pass a health care bill with universal coverage. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
The New York Times reports Ross Perot apparently doesn't like President Clinton's health plan. He's reportedly offering the Republican Party at least $1 million to produce a primetime TV program against the Clinton plan. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 21 points to end at 3,646. This is NPR. The presidents of North and South Korea will meet twice during their upcoming summit. Delegates at pre-summit talks in Panmunjom reached that agreement today. But there are many other issues around the summit that are still in dispute. South Korean officials say the North is balking at live television coverage because the North just wants videotape and film. The North is resisting the South's effort to send advanced teams to the summit site in Pyongyang weeks before the meeting. These are supposed to start on July 25th. South Korea is reminding the North that if the nuclear issue can be resolved, it will offer direct trade, investment, and other economic aid to the North. The United Nations World Health Organization says that globally, AIDS cases have increased substantially in the past 12 months. Linda Fasulo reports.
In a statement released Friday, Dr. Michael Merson, head of the World Health Organization's AIDS program, says the number of estimated AIDS cases worldwide has increased 60% in the last year, from 2.5 million cases to 4 million cases. Of that number, two-thirds of the cases are in sub-Saharan Africa, 10% in the United States. But Merson says the global AIDS epidemic is spreading fastest in Asia, which has experienced an eightfold increase of cases from 30,000 to 250,000. Meanwhile, in the past year, 3 million adults have been infected with HIV, the virus which causes AIDS, and an estimated 30 to 40 million people will be infected by the year 2000. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
The government says the index of leading economic indicators showed no change in May. It's the second straight month that the government's measure of future economic activity has remained unchanged. Some analysts had predicted a slight rise in May, and they say new data suggests the economy is growing at a healthy pace, but not like the booming growth chalked up at the end of last year. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know who's doing a cabaret act at Rainbow and Stars, one of New York's top rooms? Leslie Gore. Everyone who listened to Top 40 radio in the mid-60s knew her hits. It's My Party, Judy's Turn to Cry, She's a Fool, You Don't Own Me, That's the Way Boys Are, and Maybe I Know. You know who produced her? Quincy Jones. These were some of his big pop records, long before the Michael Jackson days. In Gore's cabaret act, she sings Cole Porter and George and Ira Gershwin, as well as the songs that made her famous. She's still singing this one, my favorite. When I spoke with her in 1991, she told me it's a song she chose herself.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me.
At the time, I know I chose it because I liked the strength in the lyric. But for me, it was not a song about being a woman. It was a song about being a person and what was involved with that. Of course, it got picked up as an anthem for women, which makes me very proud. And today, when I sing that song, I don't know, maybe it's after the Anita Hill hearings and a number of other things that have seem to be happening in our world, You Don't Own Me takes on a whole other set of meanings for me now.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have come to see it as a proto-feminist anthem.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't think of it that way when you were recording it?
I didn't. What I was impressed with was the strength. I've always hated wimpy woman. I've never understood it. So when I first heard this piece of material, I knew it was one I wanted to do.
Now, how did you choose it? How was it offered to you?
This is a great story. I was actually practically kidnapped in a hotel up in the Catskills, Grossinger's, when it was still in existence. I had gone up there to do some promotion for WAEB, and Gene Kay, who was a major disc jockey in the Allentown area, and I was sitting at the pool, and two young men from Philadelphia, John Madera and Dave White, literally took me into one of the cabanas and played me You Don't Own Me on just a guitar and sang it for me. I fell in love with it immediately, and I made an appointment for them to come into New York on Monday and sing it for Quincy Jones, who also loved it.
So they let you choose your own songs. I mean, I don't know if everybody had that opportunity.
Well, with Quincy and I, as a matter of fact, Quincy was into the show at the Rainbow and Stars a couple of Friday evenings ago, and we had a wonderful reunion, and one of the things we talked about was a couple of the songs that he made me record that I never wanted to record. And what we would do at that time is he would find something or say he didn't want me to record something, and we would negotiate it out. I would do the song I didn't want to do for him, and he would do the song ostensibly he didn't want to do, but for me.
So which songs did he make you do?
Oh, there was a song called Sometimes I Wish I Were a Boy. I really hated that one. And there was another one called I Struck a Match. Oh, it was hateful. And as a matter of fact, we had a terrific joke about it. He got this fantastic velvet box from Cartier and presented it with to me the day that the album was released with I Struck a Match on it. And I opened it up and it was a huge wooden match.
Need I point out, these songs were not hits.
Need you point out, indeed. Of course not. I knew my stuff.
Now, what's the story behind how you made your first record?
Well, it's an unusual story, but not in showbiz terms. I was studying with a vocal coach in the New York area, a man by the name of Myron Earnhardt, and one day I went in to do my lesson, and he said to me that he had booked a tiny recording studio just upstairs from him. We took the piano player and went upstairs and did, I think, 4 piano voice demos, pretty much 1, 2, 3, 4, right in a row. And when I left there that day, I literally had 2 what looked like 78 size records and 2 songs, one on each side. And we pressed up a couple of these. And as it happened, a man by the name of Joe Glazer, who was the president of ABC Booking, which was a booking agency, met Irving Green, who was president of Mercury Records, and played him my demos. Irving was impressed with the fact that I was 16 and had an interesting feel for music, and he needed a project for Quincy Jones, so he put us together.
Was this the Joe Glazer who was Armstrong's agent, too?
That's exactly the man, yes. He was quite an individual, quite a man.
So It's My Party was the very first side you recorded?
That's right. Quincy brought maybe 200 demo records to my house several Saturdays before we had gone into the studio. And because I had never sat and picked this kind of material before, the first record he put on for me was a song called It's My Party, and it was demoed by, I don't actually know who actually sang the song. And it was a very spirited little tune, and I liked it because there was something kind of rebellious in its attitude. And when it was over, Quincy said, well, what do you think of that little bit? So I said, well, I like it, but I don't know if it's, let's put it in the maybe pile. And after we went through 200 demos, we had one maybe, and it was It's My Party.
So what do you remember of that first recording session when you made It's My Party?
Well, the first thing I remember, which is so different from today, is we recorded 4-track. And I think most people know today that, gosh, we use 24, 32. Some people actually marry 2 machines and have 64 tracks. So the state of the art has greatly improved. This meant that we had 2 microphones basically hanging in the studio, strategically placed over the band. We had a 3rd microphone in the center of all of the background singers, and there were about 8 of them, and then I was in a little booth, and that was the 4th mic. So that was pretty much the setup. When we counted off, you heard everything that was going to be there. Today we layer a lot and we track a lot. Then you just went in and did it. When you walked out of the studio, you were pretty well mixed and knew exactly what everything sounded like.
In Ms. Magazine, there was recently a piece with you and K.D. Lang having a conversation with each other.
Yes.
And you said that when you were a kid, you'd sing in front of the mirror, and you'd slick back your hair like Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
But when you finally walked out on stage in the spring of 1963, you went dressed like a nice little girl and performed as you were expected to.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare what you wanted to look like when you started to performing with how you ended up looking?
Well, you know, I still basically have a very, I'm very sound-oriented. Image, which has become a major part of our business, is not what I would call my primary interest. So what it was really was sort of this, and you can probably relate, let's say you had a party to go to, and I might compare it to having the Ed Sullivan show to do. I would say to my mother or my cousin, what do you think I should wear? And we would, you know, then go shopping for something we thought was appropriate. Because the only influence on my life at that time was my mother, I very often walked out looking sort of like my mini mother. you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I didn't have anyone saying to me, just put on a pair of jeans and a white shirt, which probably would have felt comfortable to me at the time, but I probably would have had a problem with it. Because I did believe you get up on stage and you dress up because there are lots of people there and it's important and you want to show yourself off to your best advantage. I'm a little bit more savvy now in terms of image, but at 16, you don't necessarily have a clear-cut image of yourself.
Well, if you're going shopping with your mother for performances, you're not going to end up looking like the Ronettes.
Exactly.
Singer Leslie Gore is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together. Brighter than a lucky penny. When you're near, the rain goes, disappears, dear, and I feel so fine just to know that you are mine. My life is sunshine.
Leslie Gore is my guest. So what did you do when you stopped having hits?
Well, I did continue through college, and I graduated, and I'd say the hits kind of stopped in 67. I graduated college in 68. So what I did was, I'm feeling kind of like a musician without a place to play, I began doing other things, like summer stock, and getting into other areas of my craft, not just singing, and not just singing on a stage, but singing as a character, and getting a bit more into acting. And I think that formative period in my life has probably stood me in the greatest stead, because today I get up on a stage and I do sing, but for me, singing is actually secondary. The singing is what I do and how I communicate it. But I'm not thinking about singing. I'm thinking about the situation in the song. And what happens is an intense identification with lyric, which comes out as acting.
Mm-hmm. Let me play something that's from the 60s, from an album called My Town, My Guy and Me. And this is a standard. This is a Julie Stein, Sammy Kahn song called The Things We Did Last Summer. Was it your idea to do a standard on this? I want to show a different side of your singing.
Probably. You know, the very first album that Quincy and I did together, we had to base it on It's My Party, but we had to throw it together quite quickly, and it was called I'll Cry If I Want To, and it was all cry songs. It was Cry Me a River. It was the Johnny Ray's cry. So we had established a premise early on whereby I would do standards, maybe with just a slight rock and roll edge. But by and large, I don't think of The Things We Did Last Summer as a rock piece. We did it, I think, just because I loved the song. I believe Don Costa did the arrangement, and a superlative one.
Okay, let's hear it. I think we'll hear a different side of your singing.
Sure.
The boat rides we would take, the moonlight on the lake, the way we danced and hummed our favorite song. The things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long.
Since the early 70s, have you been singing a lot on the oldie circuit? I guess there really wasn't an oldie circuit in the early 70s.
There wasn't, actually. The oldies really began coming back strong, I'd say, right after 1980. About 1980, 81, it really started to pick up. And I did, in fact, take advantage of it, and it certainly actually during the 70s, no one wanted to hear Leslie Gore. I was writing my own material and working small clubs, tiny clubs, and doing mostly original material. So this whole nostalgia kick at least helped me out financially at a time that it was fairly grim for me. But I did, in fact, put the show together that I'm doing now at the Rainbow and Stars because you just can't do the same thing all the time. If you're an artist, you have to grow and you have to find new roads to grow. And for me, this was an opportunity to sing songs in some cases I've never sung, in some cases songs that I was majorly influenced by as a kid, and just an opportunity to get up and show people that there is another side to me. As a matter of fact, maybe more important to show myself that there's another side of me.
Leslie Gore, do you know what's become of Susan Michaels, who was the president of the Leslie Gore fan club?
Yes, I do. Susan Michaels was an amalgam of my middle name, which is Sue, and my brother's first name, which is Michael. And it was actually my grandma, my Nana, who is no longer with us, who became Susan Michaels and would try to answer all the fan mail personally and handwritten. And that's who Susan Michaels was.
Oh, that's great. So when did the fan club officially break up?
Well, I'm trying to think, there is yet an official Leslie Gore fan club. About 15 years ago, a gentleman by the name of Jack Natoli, who lives in Paterson, New Jersey, asked if he could be the president, and we turned everything over to him, and he does an incredible job.
Well, Leslie Gore, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Leslie Gore is performing at Rainbow and Stars in New York through July 16th. Our interview was recorded in 1991. This is Fresh Air. Yasser Arafat returned to the Gaza Strip today. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what will we have on All Things Considered?
We have a report from Gaza on the triumphant return of Yasser Arafat. And we also have a piece from Ted Clark, a profile on Yasser Arafat. It's Ted Clark sort of represents what we hope to do, to bring a kind of quiet, rational approach to hot issues. And this profile of a man who is a saint to one side and a demon to the other, I think, is a good example of his work, and it's well worth listening to. We're also covering the O.J. Simpson trial. We'll have legal analysis, reaction from Los Angeles, and Noah Adams has another take on the popularity of liturgical chants.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As writers, the husband and wife team of Charles Shire and Nancy Myers hit it big in 1980 with Private Benjamin. Then Shire decided to direct the scripts that he and Myers wrote. Together, they've made Irreconcilable Differences, Father of the Bride, and the new Julia Roberts Nick Nolte movie, I Love Trouble. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
The evidence is pretty unscientific, I'll admit, but by my recent estimate, every 12 minutes, somewhere in America, someone is watching one of the great comedies of the 30s and 40s and saying, I don't see why we can't do something like that today. It's a dream that never dies among producers and screenwriters. Unfortunately, it's also a dream that never comes true. Take, for example, I Love Trouble, the latest attempt to resurrect the bubbly spirit of Tracy and Hepburn, William Powell and Myrna Loy, and especially of the great newspaper comedies like The Front Page and His Girl Friday. Filmmakers Shire and Myers at least know the value of star power in an enterprise like this. They've spiffed up Nick Nolte to make him a reasonable simulacrum of Spencer Tracy, all craggy, twinkle-eyed charm. And they've worked like so many little Prozac pills to pull Julia Roberts out of the funk she's been in movies like The Pelican Brief and Dying Young. This is her brightest, leggiest, toothiest performance since Pretty Woman. And instead of employing her limited power to act, it uses her seemingly unlimited power to shine. The setting is Chicago, and Nolte plays Peter Brackett, star columnist of the Chicago Chronicle. Roberts is Sabrina Peterson, the new reporter at the Chronicle's crosstown rival, The Globe. They meet at a mysterious train wreck, where Peterson tries to get the story, while Brackett tries to get her.
First day on the job?
No, it's not my first day on the job.
Second? Look, all I'm trying to say is that if you'd been in town any longer, I'm sure we would have met. And had I seen you, we would have. My name's Brackett. I work for the Chronicle. Where are you from, Peterson?
Look, I realize every cub reporter in the skirt must go gaga at the great Peter Brackett approaching them, but I can't believe you're trying to hit on me while I'm covering a story. So let me set you straight. You have zero chance of scoring here. Trust me. Move on.
I'm sorry. Where'd you say you're from? Bitchville?
Unfortunately, the banter never gets much wittier than that. But that, at least, is far preferable to the plot. A quagmire of lurking villains in raincoats, secret scientific formulas, and hidden microfilms that gradually swallows up everything around it. The inevitable romance between Brackett and Peterson is constructed of clichés so sturdy that they almost work again. Like the one about how he likes steak and she eats only health food. And the one about how they're such ruthless newspaper types that whenever he goes to the bathroom, she searches his wallet to see what scoops he's uncovered. And when she goes, he rifles through her purse. This would be a lot more amusing if it didn't occur every 10 minutes or so. A bit of bladder control might have helped this movie a lot. In the end, though, nothing could have. At its best, I Love Trouble never gets beyond kind of cute. And at its worst, it's a depressing reminder that they don't make him like they used to because they haven't the vaguest idea how to.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Rhythm and Blues, we talk with Johnny Otis. He led the first R&B road show and discovered Etta James, Hank Ballard, and Big Mama Thornton. You might remember his own hit, Willie and the Hand Jive. Also, Laverne Baker remembers her hits, Jim Dandy, Bumblebee, and Tweedledee. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.